of military vehicles drive deep into the New Mexico desert. It's a scorching summer's afternoon in the middle of July 1945. At the tail end of the group is a trio of buses filled with tired, bedraggled men. No one talks much. Sweat drips from their brows as they climb to the top of a hill. Several miles away, at a site the conquistadors called Journey of the Dead, there's a 100-foot steel tower holding a nuclear bomb.
There were no computers. There were no modern electronics. They were doing everything with wires and tape. It looked like it was wrapped up with duct tape, and it was, basically. But it was very precise. It had to be. Everything had to work perfectly.
Darkness descends. The men count the minutes till the detonation scheduled for 2 a.m. Every nut, bolt, and screw has been double-checked and every equation scrutinized in minute detail. But nobody can control the weather, and shortly after midnight, a violent storm breaks. Wind, rain, and lightning tear across the landscape.
The weatherman was told by General Groves, if the weather doesn't clear in time to have a pre-dawn detonation, then he was fired. Or maybe he was going to be shot, but I mean, Groves was extremely agitated.
Tension crackles among the men as the detonation is pushed back and back again. And then, in the hour before sunrise, the weather starts to clear. The weatherman can breathe again. Welder's goggles are handed out. In the desert, there is total silence. In 60 seconds, 5 miles away and in clean line of sight, detonation of the world's first atomic bomb will be attempted. One of the scientists has run a sweepstake on the success or failure of the test. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Will it work? Or will it kill them all? As the countdown begins, there's interference from a local radio station. A waltz by the Russian composer Tchaikovsky hisses over the line. Klaus Fuchs waits with bated breath. And then, a sight like no other lights up the world in front of him.
Whoever heard the sound quietly at dawn, with a few seconds' delay, this flash of light unfolded quietly, formed this mushroom, shimmered in a wide variety of colors, and then rose up.
Brigadier General Thomas Farrell was bewildered by how the whole country was lighted up by a searing light with the intensity many times that of the midday sun. It was golden, purple, violet, gray, and blue. It lighted every peak, crevice, and ridge of the nearby mountain range with a clarity and beauty that cannot be described.
For most of the scientists, it is job done. But for nuclear physicist and Soviet spy Klaus Fuchs, he knows that this is just the start of his work.
Of course, the uneasy question came up, what will happen to this atomic bomb?
From the BBC World Service, I'm Rosa Ellis, and this is season 2 of The Bomb. Episode 6, Camp Y. 10 months prior to the Trinity test of the nuclear bomb, Klaus Fuchs had found himself at the heart of the biggest secret on the planet and the most secure place on Earth. The Los Alamos site was now running at its full potential. From a few simple buildings and dormitories, the complex had become the workplace and home of 40,000 people. From the world's top nuclear scientists to generals, engineers, builders, factory hands and cooks. It was a little world, the most elite campus in the history of universities. The theoretical physicist, J. Robert Oppenheimer, had assembled the best and brightest scientists he could recruit. Cindy Kelly from the Atomic Heritage Foundation.
So this is naturally where Fuchs and his colleagues from the British mission, who were also extraordinary, were sent to collaborate and to work on the hardest problems of getting the atomic bombs ready for delivery.
The Manhattan Project spans the length and breadth of the USA, with major industrial projects and university collaborations. But it is at Los Alamos that all overriding technical and scientific problems are solved. And it's at Los Alamos that the bombs will finally be built. It is the beating heart of the whole operation, and the Soviets have worked tirelessly to recruit people on the inside. Their most important catch by far is Klaus Fuchs. But there's a snag. He's lost contact with his Soviet handler, Harry Gold. Fuchs left New York before he could tell Gold where he was going. Has he been caught, returned to the UK, or moved deeper into the secret Manhattan Project? They have no way of knowing. Leading the British team is Klaus Fuchs's friend and boss, Rudolf Piles. Jo Hookway is his daughter.
It was a huge community of physicists and their families. And I think they sort of had a good community there. And I think as far as my father was concerned, it was all the best physicists in sort of in his area. They were all together and able to work together. And so I think, you know, the physics was exciting, although they knew what they were working towards.
Yeah.
But I think there is something about working together on a sort of project like that and working with people that you admire and respect.
Absolutely. Was there any sort of moral quandary, though, about, you know, the ultimate use of what they were working on?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think what the scientists felt was they would develop this and then it would be used as a deterrent and that it would never, ever be used in anger.
A large proportion of the scientists at Los Alamos have fled the scourge of fascism in Europe. Men like Piles and Fuchs. They're under no illusion about the destructive potential of what they're creating. But they hope that if its power can be demonstrated, then that alone could be decisive in ending the war. The gravity of their mission, the relentless work, and the claustrophobic secrecy are not easy to bear.
Husbands who are used to sharing with their wives everything about the ins and outs of their academic life were not allowed to confide in their wives. There were isolation issues. Some said this is like being in a concentration camp.
The scientists and their partners throw parties to let off steam. Fuchs may be a man of few words, but on the dance floor, he's something of a catch. He's the guy that every good party needs, the one at the head of the conga line.
He was a wonderful dancer. All the women wanted to dance with him.
Author Nancy Thorndike Greenspan.
It actually turned out that older women really liked Klaus. Women that were a little bit older than he was. And all of his girlfriends were older than he was. You know, they mothered him. He was, since he was kind of quiet and reserved, he didn't ask for much. He'd get sick. They say, oh, you know, what do you need? You know, let me come over and cook for you and things like that. They bring him dinner, you know? So he had that side of his life as well, which was very nice.
Fuchs also earns a reputation as a man who can hold huge amounts of alcohol and still seem completely in control. I find it almost impossible to imagine the degree of self-control it takes to live a hermetically sealed double life. Always aware that one step out of line, one sentence out of place, could betray a deadly secret. Every moment must feel like balancing on a tightrope with no net to catch you if you fall. On Sundays, Fuchs and his friends regularly head out into the surrounding wilderness to hike and ride horses. They even cut down trees to make a ski slope. And again, he seems to test the limits of his self-control, confounding his colleagues as he climbs cliff faces and escarpments where one misstep could mean catastrophe. But ever the paradox, he also earns their trust as a chauffeur and babysitter.
Fuchs was a close colleague of Edward Teller, and he's also a babysitter for their children, incidentally, and would take Teller's wife on picnics, you know, drive her where she needed to go with his car. So he was ingratiated with Edward Teller and his family.
Edward Teller, a highly talented physicist obsessed with the idea of the hydrogen bomb. It's not the kind of bomb that's being built at Los Alamos, but it is an idea that in time, the Americans, Brits, and Russians will all want to know a whole lot more about.
Klaus Fuchs was a very good friend and collaborator of Teller's, so he no doubt knew a lot about the hydrogen bomb.
Fuchs is once again ahead of the game, but the boundary between friendship and exploitation is blurred and murky. He understands that to be a good spy, he needs to build intimacy and trust.
You not only contribute something professionally as a scientist, but also you must be accepted as a human being and to cultivate your friendships. A human being does not live in a vacuum. He needs to integrate himself into the environment and use that too in order to win the appropriate recognition. In the beginning, I probably did it subconsciously, later, partly consciously. Perhaps also with a bit of arrogance, that I was a bit smug about myself, that I knew that I had the personal relationships under my control. You have to be very cautious. I'm one of those people who does not make contacts easily, but when they do, then the contact is very close. And then you are sometimes confronted with situations.
Situations over which Fuchs has no control. He isn't aware of it, but within the friendships Fuchs is forming are the seeds of future confrontations. As Fuchs is ingratiating himself with his colleagues on picnics and in the laboratory, the overall boss of the atomic bomb program, General Groves, is trying to enforce a strict security regime. He is a highly competent engineer and manager, but first and foremost, he is a military man. Secrecy and chain of command are in his blood, so he tries to compartmentalise and isolate each team. But science doesn't work like that. Minds like these can't be kept in a box. They question, collaborate, and dispute their way to the answers. The scientific director, J. Robert Oppenheimer, pushes back and ultimately wins the day.
They had to talk to each other. There wasn't time to go down a dead end or a blind alley. I mean, there were enough as it was, but try to avoid that by talking to each other and collaborating. Oppenheimer had instituted a series of colloquia in which the senior scientists were presented a problem, invite others to contribute. And it worked. So they invited mathematicians and engineers and chemists and physicists and mechanical engineers to kibitz, to work together to solve problems. And all of this was done openly in these colloquia to which Fuchs was invited.
If Los Alamos is the nerve center of the whole Manhattan Project, the theoretical division is the brain. All roads of inquiry lead here. It's where the best physicists and mathematicians can offer solutions.
Everything can be solved by bringing in the expertise of the theoretical division.
Author Mike Rossiter.
That's why, if you're in the theoretical division, you know everything that's going on in Los Alamos. And surprise, surprise, Fuchs is right in the middle of it. He was a mathematician who had a particular knack, a particular skill of applying mathematics to what had actually become a key element of nuclear physics, which was the whole question of quantum mechanics and probability. And so whenever there was a theoretical problem to solve or an underpinning of a nuclear reaction to elucidate, they would bring Fuchs in, because of his particular skill at mathematically being able to calculate the theoretical basis for why something should happen.
The development of the uranium bomb is well advanced. Based on Fuchs's and the team's work in the UK and New York, the world's longest roofed structure is being built. It houses the mile-long gaseous diffusion plant they need to separate the uranium-235 from the uranium-238. The theory is well established. Once they have enough of the U-235, they can put two lumps of it into the casing of a bomb. A trigger fires the two mounds of uranium together, creating a critical mass, and boom, a nuclear explosion. But they are also working on a different kind of nuclear bomb, one with plutonium in its core, and this one needs a completely different detonation method. The trigger mechanism used for the uranium bomb won't work, as the plutonium atom splits so fast, the chain reaction will fizzle out too quickly. This presents a whole new complex set of problems. Klaus Fuchs's mathematical skills are once again in high demand.
So the idea arose to create an implosion as opposed to an explosion. A blast going outwards is getting weaker. An implosion going in from all sides is getting stronger, and it's going much faster, and it's also compressing the material to extraordinarily high densities. There is a possibility that fluctuations occur here, meaning everything doesn't flow together in a nice circle. But there are effects that interrupt this convergence, or individual parts move faster and the detonator in the middle of the bomb explodes too quickly. This turned out to be my specialty again.
Creating an almost perfectly uniform implosion proves immensely difficult. But Fuchs is integral to the team that comes up with an ingenious solution. They surround a ball of plutonium with a series of extremely accurate explosive lenses.
Each of these lenses was like a soccer ball.
That is, there are 36 hexagonal and septagonal pieces that fit together in a sphere.
So they pattern the lenses in these same shapes, 36 of them around the core, and they wired each one with a detonator that was to go off at exactly the same nanosecond. So it had to be perfect. This was a huge problem.
The electronics are elementary, and there is zero room for error. Solutions are to be found in mathematical formula.
And they needed all the talent they could get, and Fuchs was there at the ready.
What they discovered was that what you needed inside that small ball of plutonium was another tiny piece of radioactive material shaped very specifically. It's made out of polonium, by the way. And that tiny little thing, it's probably about the size of an acorn, goes in this ball of plutonium. Fuchs was one of the four people who worked on the shape and composition of that urchin.
That is the trigger. The speed and scale of developments at Los Alamos are breathtaking. And Fuchs is in the beating heart of it all. But he has nobody to share his insights with. He lost contact with Soviet agent Harry Gold when he left New York. And surrounded by the high-level security of Los Alamos, there's no simple way to re-establish communication. And here, the story takes a personal turn. Before he left, he gave Gold the address of his sister Crystal, who lives in the small town of Cambridge near Boston. Fuchs assured him she could be trusted. They say don't mix family with business. Well, mixing family with espionage is a particularly risky strategy that will haunt Klaus Fuchs in the years to come. On the morning of October 24th, 1944, Harry Gold walks up the steps of 144 Lakeview Avenue, Cambridge. He's carrying sweets for the kids and a new war novel, A Bell for Adano, as a gift for Crystal. It's his third attempt to make contact, and he's getting desperate. He takes a deep breath, straightens his jacket and knocks. Silence. Gold is just about to give up when he hears footsteps. A slender woman in her early 30s with long dark hair and brown eyes opens the door. She's beautiful but has a sad demeanour. Gold's shoulders visibly relax.
Greetings from Max.
Crystal recognises the code words and responds. I heard he had twins.
Yeah, 7 days ago.
What she told Harry at that particular time was that she hadn't heard from Klaus and she didn't know where he was. He had just come to visit and he hadn't said, I guess, where he was going. And she didn't know where he was.
Worse still, she thinks he's returned to England. Gold can't afford to give up. He comes back the following Thursday with more sweets, a different novel. And this time the news is good. Klaus has been in contact. He's told Crystal that he's working in New Mexico and he's coming to stay soon. Harry Gold can hardly contain his relief. He stays for lunch and says he'll be back in a few weeks. In February 1945, Fuchs finally makes a visit to his sister Crystal.
I remember that that's when my mother would smile. That's when I remember her smiling. It's almost the only times I remember her smiling.
Really?
Yes. Well, she was very deeply depressed.
Fuchs's niece, Marcia Saunders, was a little girl when he turned up at the family home.
He was an absolutely lovely uncle. He brought us wonderful presents. He brought me an abacus, I remember, when I must have been 4 years old. And I learned how to multiply from an abacus. So when I later went to school, I was very confused. Because that wasn't the way they did it.
And did he teach you on the abacus?
Yeah.
Did he show you how
to
use it?
Well, he played with me on the abacus and he showed me. It didn't feel like teaching, it felt like playing. Remember, he brought my brother a chemistry set and that was pretentious because my brother became really a very eminent geneticist and biologist.
Oh, really?
He was a professor at the Salk Institute.
As Marcia busies herself with her new abacus, the mother passes to her uncle a number for Gold. Fuchs slips it into his pocket and wastes no time in contacting his man from Soviet intelligence. Within days, Gold is once again knocking on the door of 144 Lakeview Avenue. And this time, Klaus Fuchs is there to greet him.
Good to see you.
They exchange pleasantries before heading up to the guest room where Fuchs is staying.
And Klaus had a lot of information that he was able to give to Harry at that time.
It's been 7 months since they last met, and Fuchs passes over several pages of notes he's written from memory, including the dimensions and principles of construction of the uranium bomb. He also has the crucial and unexpected intel that they're not just working on the uranium bomb, but on the plutonium bomb as well. Gold listens intently and takes the notes Fuchs gives him, and then he hesitates and shifts in his seat. He feels uncomfortable but starts to speak. He tries to offer Fuchs $1,500.
And Klaus was very upset. He did not like to be offered money. He wasn't a money person. As he said, I earn a good living and I'd have no need for money and I don't want it. No.
But Fuchs does have one request. Thousands of miles away, across the Atlantic, the Red Army is sweeping in through Eastern Europe and into Germany. The Nazis are in retreat.
So he said, when the Russian soldiers get there, when they enter Kiel and Berlin, destroy all the Gestapo files.
Security, not money, is all that Fuchs wants from the Russians. Secrets sleep, but they never really die. He knows that the Gestapo files will have detailed records of his communist activism as a student. And he doesn't want that falling into the wrong hands. The Brits and Americans are on the march through Western Europe. Hitler's demise is all but assured. And then, in May 1945, the Germans surrender.
This is V-Day in Germany. And here, in the old town of Lüneburg, we're standing in the main square where the Germans have assembled. In the hot May sun, a victory sun, if there ever was one, is blazing down on us. We've got no flags or bunting out. Instead, a single white sheet of surrender hangs from one of the town hall windows.
And in his victory speech to the nation, Winston Churchill applauds the sacrifices of Britain's Soviet allies.
Pay a particular tribute to the heroic Russian comrades.
Many of the scientists at Los Alamos are refugees from the Nazis. They'd been working on the bomb to ensure Hitler's defeat.
So in their mind, the purpose for which they were building the bomb no longer existed, and no one needed to use the bomb.
But war in the Pacific burns on, with the Japanese intent on fighting to the very end. There's still huge pressure from the US government and military to get the bombs built. There's no need to test the uranium bomb. The science is watertight, and in any case, there's only enough uranium for one bomb. The plutonium bomb, on the other hand, is profoundly complex, and any number of things could go wrong. And so, in July 1945, Klaus Fuchs finds himself in the desert in the early hours, wearing welder's goggles as a Tchaikovsky waltz hisses across the countdown. As the blinding flash of light passes, a mushroom tower rises up into the heavens. Awe, relief, terror. For Fuchs and those watching, there's no doubt now about the godlike destructive powers of the weapon they have helped to create. But what should it be used for? Is mankind going to be able to control this instrument that could destroy civilization? When the scientists return to base at Los Alamos, they debate how to ensure it won't be used on civilians.
There were discussion groups among the scientists about this very issue, but Fuchs did not participate in them.
He simply says, it's too late for that now. He's under no illusion that this weapon of unimaginable force is now well out of the control of the scientists. His colleagues club together and lobby the hawkish President Truman to secure a guarantee that the bomb won't be dropped on Japan unless the terms of surrender are made public and Japan publicly refuses. The Allies call for the Japanese unconditional surrender, the alternative being prompt and utter destruction. The Japanese government ignores the ultimatum. Fuchs is ever the realist. He knows that the people calling the shots now are the generals and politicians, and he's right. Truman has already made his decision in agreement with Britain's Winston Churchill. The answer comes on August the 6th, 1945, in the Japanese city of Hiroshima. The uranium bomb lays waste to the city. And then 3 days later, the plutonium bomb is dropped on Nagasaki.
And I suddenly saw a brilliant flash which lit up the entire area of Nagasaki. I threw myself on the ground. The walls of the building in which I was taking shelter collapsed. I saw two American planes in the sky. After a while, all of us rushed to the far end of the dock, where we could see the port of Nagasaki wrapped in flames. But on passing through it a month later, I was thunderstruck with the complete and utter devastation of the place.
Hundreds of thousands of people are killed, most of them civilians. Japan is defeated. World War II is over. The Allies' justification for bombing the heavily populated cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is to bring the war to a swift end and avoid the need for a full invasion of mainland Japan and the deaths of tens of thousands of American troops. But from Russia's perspective, it doesn't look that way. Alexander Vasilyev is a Russian journalist and former KGB operative.
Why the Americans bombed Japan, Hiroshima and Nagasaki? In the Soviet history and Russian history, the most popular idea was that it wasn't to defeat Japan. The main goal was to scare the Soviets, because Japan was about to surrender anyway.
Stalin had agreed with the Allies that following the victory in Europe, he would be able to redirect and regroup his forces within 3 months to join the fight against the Japanese. In return, Russia received guarantees over some of its long-standing territorial ambitions in the Far East. By August 1945, Japan is battered. Its cities have been levelled, its forces stretched. And now they have the Russians invading from the north.
Japan had no chance. They would surrender anyway.
But just as the Red Army is entering the affray, the bombs are dropped.
So in the Soviet point, in the Russian point of view, the main goal of bombing Hiroshima and Nagasaki is to threaten the Soviets.
And ensure that Asia isn't carved up in the same way that Europe has been. And this is how Klaus Fuchs sees it.
That's what it was all about. It was a trump card against the Soviet Union. Of course, we weren't told that, and the scientists weren't told that. They were told it's about saving the lives of American soldiers who, without the atomic bomb, would have to carry out an invasion of the Japanese islands, and hundreds of thousands would have to sacrifice their lives.
For all the scientists who helped build the bomb, there must have been a great moral reckoning with what they'd helped bring into existence. They had tried to stop it being used on civilians, and failed. And now, with communist Russia and the capitalist West competing to shape the new world order in their favour, would it be used again? Heidi and Marcia are the daughters of Klaus's sister, Crystal.
He was utterly horrified, utterly, utterly horrified, and determined that it should never be used again. Yeah. And I don't think he had any particular reason to think that the Americans would never use it again. He wanted to be sure that other countries, that nobody used it, and that's part of the whole thing about getting some kind of atomic energy commission set up.
Yeah.
But I think he was absolutely horrified.
Yeah, that's what I heard from Crystal, too. She did talk to him about that, and she said that he told her that he, you know, he was just determined that it wouldn't be used, and he felt that the Soviet Union and the United States were the two most likely to have it,
yeah.
And felt that if they, those two powers had it, that nobody would use it.
After the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, scientists intensely and openly debate the control of atomic weapons. Some even argue that if Washington doesn't agree, then the scientists themselves have a duty to act. Fuchs stays conspicuously silent. A month after the Japan bombings, the British mission is packing up to leave Los Alamos.
And they were planning this big party to say goodbye to everybody.
And for the party, they would need booze. This will involve a trip to Santa Fe. And Fuchs is one of the few people at Los Alamos who has a car.
His was an old Buick that he had bought for $50. It was a real beat-up car. So he offered to go get it, but it just turned out, by coincidence, that this coincided with the time that he had already set up with Harry Gold to come to Santa Fe so that he could give him more information.
They've arranged to meet by a church on Bishop's Lodge Road on the outskirts of the city. Gold turns up on time, but there's no sign of Fuchs. He waits and starts to get increasingly nervous. Never has Fuchs's atomic espionage been more pressing. Everyone knows what the bomb can do, and Russia is working full throttle to build its own. Finally, Fuchs pulls up and Gold gets in. Fuchs quickly turns the conversation to the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Well, were you impressed?
I was impressed, I guess. But horrified also.
They drive for a while up into the hills overlooking Santa Fe. With the bombs built and dropped and all the test results in, Fuchs has a final motherload of information to give to Gold.
So he was able to give him the specifics, especially about the plutonium test. There were specifics from there. He could talk about the blast waves, the construction. He could also tell him about the U.S. production of U-235, the fissile piece, and about plutonium.
Gold walks away from the meeting with the blueprint for the atomic bomb. It's hard to overstate the significance of what Klaus Fuchs has handed over, and its profound implications for global politics for decades to come.
The man in charge of the Soviet bomb project, Igor Khrushchev, was under the gun, literally, to get an atomic bomb for the Soviet Union. He reported directly to one of the most ruthless people that reported to Stalin, Leventi Beria, who was the chief of the secret police. and responsible for millions of deaths. So Kurchatov was afraid. He would be on the floor in a minute with a bullet in his head.
Failure is not an option. So for Kurchatov, the intel coming from Los Alamos is literally a lifesaver. His Russian team are suspicious. Why does he constantly override their suggestions?
They began to wonder, where is he getting these ideas? And he claimed that there were other Russian scientists who were supplying him with their expertise, when in fact, this was a lie. He had his desk drawer full of blueprints and diagrams and instructions based on information that was sent by the Soviet handlers who were sending information directly from Los Alamos.
As most of the Brits bid farewell to Los Alamos and head home, Fuchs stays on. The Americans want him to stay, as many of their own scientists have returned to academia. And the Brits? Well, they're happy to have him stay in the States for a while. With the war over, it's far from certain how far the Americans will be prepared to cooperate with Britain's own nuclear program. If Fuchs stays an extra few months, then he can magpie information for his colleagues back in the UK. Britain and America are both trying to extract as much as possible from a man who is deceiving them both. Finally, on the 28th of June 1946, Klaus Fuchs packs his bags and boards an RAF plane. He's accepted a post in the heart of Britain's nuclear program. The World War may be over, but the Cold War is just beginning. The secrets must keep flowing. Next time on The Bomb.
If Britain wanted to remain a world power, they had to have a nuclear weapon.
In the late 1940s, of course, it was a different story for Klaus Fuchs meeting with a Soviet diplomat and talking to him, and it was pretty dangerous.
Michael Serpell wrote a memo, a very strong memo, saying, how can you have this person as director of theoretical research in a top secret security place?
You can subscribe to The Bomb on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd appreciate it if you'd leave a rating or a review to help other people find it. The Bomb was presented by me, Rosa Ellis. It was written and produced by Zach Brophy. The story editor was Emma Harding. Alice McKee was the assistant producer. Our producer in Berlin was Sabine Scherek. Klaus Fuchs was played by Marcus Calvin, with additional performances by David Hounslow. Sound design was by Tim Nielsen at Skywalker Sound and Steve Brook. Original music was composed by Trevor Gorekis, with additional original music by Ben Marshall. The executive producer was Glyn Tansley, and the podcast was commissioned by Simon Pitts at the BBC World Service.